Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Unbreakable with Jay Glazer, a mental health podcast helping you out of the gray and into the blue. Now, here's Jay Glazer.
Welcome to Unbreakable, a mental health podcast with Jay Glazer. I am Jay Glazer. And before we get into today's guest, who I'm so excited to talk to, if you're like many people, you may be surprised to learn that 1 in 5 adults in this country experienced mental illness last year. Yet, far too many fail to receive the support they need. Carolyn Behavioral Health is doing something about it. They understand that behavioral health is a key part of whole health, delivering compassionate care that treats physical, mental, emotional, and social needs in tandem. Carolyn Behavioral Health, raising the quality of life through empathy and action. I got a really cool guest on today because, and his career spanned so many different things. I think if you said 20 years ago, hey, it's going to take him over here to wrestling, you'd probably say, how is that possible? My dude, Freddie Prinze Jr., how are you, my man?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good. Now, people are going, wait, why are we talking about Freddie Prinze Jr. wrestling? But you have a new podcast out called Wrestling with Freddie, right?
Yeah, and that's correct.
Okay, so before I kind of jump into how you got it, man, I went to WrestleMania 1.
That's amazing.
Dude, so it was Madison Square Garden. It was Hulk Hogan and Mr. T versus Rowdy Piper and Paul Orndorff. And Muhammad That's Ali right. was the referee. How fucking cool
That's
is that?
Right.
Right?
That's right, man. Yeah. Yeah. Ali and my dad were actually friends back in the 70s, and Ali used to spar with him and whip his ass all the time.
Really? Oh, my God.
Yeah, man. My dad
did a mean. Do you have footage of that?
Oh, yeah, man. My dad did a mean impression of him, and Johnny Carson asked my dad to host the show. To this day, he's the youngest person to ever host The Tonight Show.
Wow.
And my dad had George Foreman on as a guest, and they reenacted Zaire, and my dad was Ali. And Foreman was Foreman, and Foreman let my dad knock him out. We actually have a towel with Ali's blood on it that says June 1st or June 21st, 1975, Ali's blood. My dad got beat up so much, he met my godfather, who was Bob Wall, who just passed away. And Bob was the guy that Bruce sought out when Bruce Lee came to America. So Bob introduced him to Gene LaBelle and Chuck Norris and all Pat Johnson and all these like legends, right? And my dad heard he was the guy that trained like all the Hollywood guys to be tough guys like Steve McQueen and James Garner. And so my dad said, you got to teach me how to fight. And my godfather taught him the left hook or a check hook, really. Right. And they were in Ali's house and they were fooling around. And my dad caught Ali with like this baby hook, right? But the couch was behind Ali, so it made Ali trip and fall. And his nose got bloody. And my dad ran to his bathroom, grabbed a towel, wiped the blood off, jumped in his 75 Stingray and hauled ass to his house. While he's driving home, Ali's calling the house, talking to my mom, saying, I'm going to kill that boy. You tell that boy I'm going to kill him when he gets home. My dad had the towel framed like a war medal on crushed purple velvet with a mahogany frame and a little brass plaque that says Ali's blood. I think it's June 21st, 1975. My mom still has it to this day. She says I can have it when she's dead. That's her, that's her exact quote.
That's unbelievable, man.
Yeah, dude.
Incredible. That is wild. I love that.
My dad charmed a lot of people that took care of me when I was a young kid. So I was
really
very
cool,
lucky.
Man. Yeah. Really cool. And look, I'm going to hit your podcast here in a little while. But you talk about your dad. How was your dad, right? He took his own life when you were just a little kid.
Yeah,
how
10 months old.
How did it affect you? And, you know, you talk obviously glowingly here, like you have this relationship with your dad. How did you have a relationship, you know, with your dad as you were growing up? Like, how did it all affect you?
Well, to start your question, it was horrible. How I dealt with it, in the beginning, I didn't. It was something that was constant pressure and this crushing weight. How I have the relationship with him I have now, as strange as that sounds to say, yeah. When you're a kid and you lose a parent at a young age, and anyone will relate to this, your knowledge of them is based on stealing memories of others. That's it. Like, you're just stealing, you're looking for anything. You're asking more questions than most kids. It makes you grow up a little bit faster. It probably stunts your growth in other ways, but you ask a lot of questions. You get a lot of adult stories. I mean, you got to understand, I was talking to guys like Richard Pryor, Paul Mooney, you know, all these wow. like legends to get stories about my dad, because Richard discovered my father. And they had that huge falling out because Pam Grier fell in love with my dad instead of Richard. And Richard, they had the same manager, and he's like, you got to pick. And the manager picked my dad, and Richard was pissed off. And, you know, when my dad died, he was still pissed at him. So it was, wow. you know, it was a crazy time back then, but it definitely, you know, it shaped me into the man I am, but it definitely didn't help me in any, that's, you know, that's a horrible thing for any kid to have to go through. And when they're famous, it just makes it more, you have to just deal with it a lot sooner. So you have to grow up a little bit quicker.
When you talk to Richard Pryor, is he like, I don't want to talk about him? Or is he like, I'll show this kid some compassion?
He looked at me and he said, boy, your father was a motherfucker, but he was a funny motherfucker. And I loved him. And it made me cry. Like, I broke down in tears. I was probably like 20, 21, 22, probably about the same age as my dad when he died.
Wow.
And he broke it down for me. Paul Mooney, I met when I was 12, and he just talked to me like I was a 40-year-old man. Like, he didn't pull any punches. He used any language he felt like using. And I just had to sit there and take it. It was me and Chris Titus, and Titus introduced me to him. And I used to hang out in the clubs when I was like 12 years old because my dad opened the Improv. So Bud would just let me hang out with all these like celebrities doing cocaine in the bathroom and all these people talking trash and talking the best smack I've ever heard on stage. And I would sit there with a spiral notebook and write their jokes down and then write how loud the audience laughed. And I had like 14 or 15 Mead notebooks filled in like 4 years because I would just spend all my time there. But all those guys helped me learn who my dad was in a more honest and realistic way than my family, who would just go, oh, he was lovely. He was wonderful. But no faults, no flaws. And those men were able to tell me the flaws, which helps you get a more three-dimensional picture of him.
You said it helped you grow up a lot, obviously a lot faster, but there's two ways you can go. You can grow up and you could be bitter and angry about it. You can grow up and say, I'm going to be more well-rounded. Is that a decision you made, or like, did you have to kind of practice that, or did it just come naturally?
It's definitely practice. I mean, I've said this before, but I credit it through martial arts. Bruce mm-hmm. Lee said martial arts is the physical expression of what we love and hate most about ourselves, but lack the vocabulary to communicate. And so when I was young, my godfather took the same approach with me, and he was very disciplined and very strict and made me work really, really hard. But that was the main thing that helped me through all that, especially through puberty. And then once puberty was done and my testosterone was in check, like my body was used to becoming a young man, then it got much easier to deal with. And I was ready for the next set of challenges that would come, which was when I came to Hollywood and then all of a sudden had to deal with constant like public questions about him in my early 20s.
Right.
And I was just grateful for the experience that I had from my godfather to prepare me that best I could, because it wasn't always easy.
Wow. Of all those comedians who sat in there, who was the funniest motherfucker that got the best laugh?
I mean, I watched Richard Pryor in a wheelchair break the Comedy Store. with full-on MS go up there, and the whole crowd was completely tense. Because you never want to see your heroes suck. You don't want to see Joe Namath as a Ram. Like, that's not the vision that you have, right? You want to see him in his prime. You want to see him, you know, killing it. And so the crowd was really nervous. They almost didn't want to see him perform. His assistant had to put the microphone in a little stand, and he's shaking, and he starts off, and his voice is real weak. And he says, can I cuss on this or no?
Fuck yeah.
Okay. It was Richard Pryor. So.
Yeah, you're talking to me too. Shit.
Okay, all right. So he says, I was at a multiple sclerosis function with Annette Funicello. And his voice is shaky like that. And the crowd's like, oh no. Like, this is, we can't watch our hero. Like, we can't watch him up here and suffer. And then he gets this little twinkle in his eye and he goes, and she sucked my dick. And he did 5 minutes on what a blowjob from Annette Funicello was like. And I won't do it justice, so I'm not going to recreate the joke for you. That's unfair to him. He's not here to beat my ass for it. But the crowd, we were all hook, line, and sinkered. Like, he brought us in with weakness and then just killed us with strength. And then after the joke was over, he just told the one joke. And then his helper came up and he said, I guess that's all I can do now. And they rolled him up. And everybody stood up and cheered longer than his set lasted.
Wow.
I'll never forget that. He literally broke the room because he had us in such a vulnerable place, right. And he knew it. The son of a bitch knew it. And then he killed everybody. It was such a genius. He's the best ever. Everyone agrees to that.
Incredible. That's incredible. Why'd you decide to get in the show biz?
my grandfather was not a fan of my dad's, and he had cancer when I was 16 years old. And was on hospice care, and he asked me to come in, or my grandmother said, your grandpa wants to talk to you. And I went into his bedroom, and we knew he didn't have much longer, and we had all kind of like made our peace. And he grabbed my hand. He looked like Popeye the Sailor Man. This guy had giant tattoos of anchors on his forearms. He was in the Navy. He had three hairs on his head. Was great with his hands, smoked a pipe. Like, he was just a cool dude. And he grabbed my hand, and he still had so much friggin' strength in it. And he said, Freddie, did you clean your room today? I'm 16 years old. I'm like, yeah. He goes, I'm so proud of you. And at 16, I didn't know. I'm like, all right. Like, I didn't know he was saying, like, for who you are and for who I think you're going to be, right? And then in the same breath, he says, you know, your father really fucked things up, and it's up to you to fix it. Later, he was dead.
Whoa.
Dead. And I'm literally was just like, oh, God, thanks for that backpack.
Right? Oh, my God.
Pressure going on being a loser sophomore in high school. Like, now I get to deal with this shit, too. So as soon as I graduated, or the last day of school, I didn't even stay to put on the gown and cap or any of that stuff. I got in my car. L.A. was closer than New York. Drove to L.A. and got started.
Wow, that's hey, that is a lot of weight, man. Oh my God.
Yeah, it sucked, but you know, it was my life, so it was what it was.
But there's two ways you can go. That can either cave you because of the weight, or you can say, no, I'm going to step up now. I'm stronger. How did you do that? How did it become you, the latter for you? That's incredible.
You know, these moments happen to us more often than I think we like to admit, the sort of breakable moments. I just think as each one passes, we're a little bit stronger and better prepared. But it's an involuntary response for me based on the way I was raised and the disciplines that Bob Wolf preached to me nonstop. I mean, I know this quote by heart, but I hated hearing it every time he said it. He would say, Freddie, you're in control of two things, your actions and your reactions to the actions of others. And anyone who tells you different is full of shit. And he said that to me every single day, multiple times. Every time I went to complain to him, there was no sympathy. There was no empathy. There was just, here is the solution to your problems. And if you can't accept it, it's not going to change. And so at an early age, I practiced that pretty well. Like, even in my 20s, I was pretty good at it. By the time I was in my 30s, I was a master of it. And now I just try to teach it to my kids.
That's incredible.
But that's what saved me. Otherwise, you know, I would have ended up like anybody else in this business who isn't prepared for fame and the pressures that come with that. And there's so many friggin' stories out there. And no matter how many of them we know, we keep falling into those traps. So it has to be based on how you're raised and the type of programming you have.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, for people, anybody out there, showbiz is about who can withstand getting rejected more than everybody else.
Yeah, and it's a multi-million dollar business, so the stakes are always so high for these people. You know, it's a lot of pressure, and you have to be able to look at it from the outside and then make your moves. Because if you just sort of, I'm a sweet kid from the Midwest and I'm jumping into it, you are dead. You are dead before your feet hit the street. Like, you have to go in there prepared, and you can't just be the prettiest person in your school. You can't just be the buffest guy on the swim team. Like, you have to be mentally tough to survive out here, or it just chews you up.
Yeah, no doubt. No, and that's the thing. Like, for even, look, I'm a different career, obviously, with sports broadcasting. But
close enough,
11
though.
Years. I was making $9,400 a year living in New York City. Just
that's not
rejected.
Living, brother. That wasn't living.
Was terrible.
That was surviving.
That was surviving. Deciding which bill was not going to get paid that month. But it was just, it's the early days. I'm like, shit, I just have to outlast everybody. I've got to be the last motherfucker standing and try and find a full-time job every week, all those weeks, over and over and over. Luckily for me, I ran into my first day on the job. I ran into another guy in the giant locker room who nobody talked to for years. He was a goofy guy with bad teeth and a speech impediment.
Oh, God.
He was drafted to replace Lawrence Taylor, and Lawrence is still on the team. So no one really talked to him. And that dude was Michael Strahan. And people don't realize that the first 4 years of his career, man, he struggled a lot. Year five, he blew it up. But he felt bad for me because how much I was struggling. And I didn't have enough money to take myself from New York City to Giant Stadium every day. So he would drive me back into New York every single day.
Come on, man.
For 7 years. So I owe Strahan like $28,000 in Lincoln Tunnel fare.
You know, I've heard so many people speak about this man the way you speak about him. No. And I only know him a little bit. Like, when he was out here in L.A. in the beginning, He asked me to teach him to surf, and then it never worked out.
Yeah, because we moved to Hermosa.
That must have been when it was. Yep. And it never worked out because I was working and then he was working. But I remember everybody, I would tell that story and people were like, dude, he's the nicest guy. He'll legit go. And I was like, I think we might. And we almost did like two or three different times. We just couldn't make our schedules fit. But I've always heard people just hold that guy in the highest regard. And I had a great experience with him.
It was great for two of us because I got to really learn football from a different perspective because his greatness was his preparation. So he'd sit there, and again, he was my ride everywhere. And he would look at film over and over and over and over. And he'd like, look over here. Look at John Runyon's foot in this play. And I'm like, what the fuck are you looking at?
John Runyon, dude.
I'm like, what are you looking at? I've got a date coming up here. You're killing me because you've got to drive into the date. But he would really show me about these tiny little things. My question to you is kind of who was that person for you when you came out here and you were able to lean on and help you in the early days? Kind of scrounge up some victories.
Peter Falk was very instrumental.
Wow, Columbo?
Yeah, man.
That's cool.
I made an independent film with him, and for whatever reason, I think it was because of my father, he took a real shine to me and put an arm around me, and it was like being in film school, and he would talk to me about the old Cassavetes days and how it was a brotherhood back then, and it wasn't a competition between it, and I was just like, God damn, it's not like that now. And so he just really helped me focus on the art, the work. He talked about the difference between skill and talent, and just really showed me a different way to prepare, a different way to look inside myself, because I wasn't able to apply life experience before Peter. Hmm. I was just able to fake it and create stuff. And I was young and green at it, but I could do it to a you know, at least an above average level. And then he helped me be so much more deliberate in my choices and helped my planning and preparation so much more, and really focusing on like two scenes and then looking at how every other scene you do in the movie affects those two scenes. And the reason he picked two was so that you would just get two different perspectives of it and then start applying that philosophy to everything. He was like having an acting coach for 2.5-3 months out there, and then was kind enough to stay in touch with me after the movie and still, you know, communicate. He would say he was proud of me when he saw me booking jobs. He'd go, I didn't see the movie, but I'm glad you got it. You know what I mean? It was like that kind of thing. But he wasn't the demo. So he was very instrumental. Brian Dennehy was another guy, only on set though. We didn't maintain a relationship after the movie, but during the filming, he really showed me what it was to be like a leading man and when to fight for what you believe in, even if the director thinks they want something different. He's like, this is on you. This movie's not on him. It's on you. So if you believe in a choice, that's the choice you do, regardless of what he says. And my brain was just so not wired for that. Cause like I said, I grew up in martial arts. Like what your professor or director tells you, you do, you execute it because something's wrong. And Brian's philosophy was like, what you did wasn't wrong. It was just different than what he wanted. But what he wanted isn't important because it's not his face on the poster. Right. I was just like,
wow.
Oh, yeah, I never even thought about that. And I started looking back at other jobs that I had done mentally, not watching them, but mentally, and remembering all these moments where I didn't fight. And I was like, oh, okay, I got it now. And so from that moment, I really changed as an actor.
What you said earlier also, Peter Falk showed you the difference between skill and talent. Sum that up for me. Sum that lesson up for us.
Sure. Talent's what brings you to Los Angeles. Skill is what gets you work for 25 years. Hmm. Talent is having an ability to be a storyteller and communicate, right? The old saying is storytellers cut no wood. Skill is using that talent, not all at the same time, knowing when to hold it back, knowing when to go for it, different, being deliberate in the choices when you break down a scene. What's the obstacle? What's your goal? And what are the ways you're going to work around that obstacle? That's how every scene is developed and crafted, and every actor approaches it in their own way, but to that effect. And so skill and talent is, you know, everyone's talented, but until you have a master who teaches you how to sharpen that blade, it's just a bat. You know what I mean? And you can still do damage with a bat, but if you sharpen it, forget about it, man. Like that's now you have a weapon and you can compete at a higher level. So,
man, I love that.
Yeah, that was probably the best way for me to describe it, but it wasn't the way he described it. I just don't have the vocabulary he had.
Hey, you also, I want to get here because obviously I've spent my life in martial arts as well. Had a couple fights early on in the early days and before Fox made me stop, which I don't understand why. I'm clearly not on TV for my looks.
Yeah, but they don't want you coming on with black eyes and no doubt. On your head, man. Get out of here.
My first day at Fox, 2004, the day before I won the Naga Worlds in submission fighting.
Get out of here.
Yeah, and but I ended up getting really fucked up in the process. My very first day of the NFL owners meeting, 2004, and I come in and my eyes shut and my foot is fucked up. My rib is broken. And the head of Fox was like, what the fuck happened to you?
His car crashed, man.
My eyes shut. I'm going, hey, I just won the World Submission Fighting Championship. She's like, I don't know what the fuck that is, but you'll never fucking do it again.
That's why you lie, bro. Make sure
that's exactly right.
Yeah. I got hit by a bus. You got to make
I kept doing it, and man, I became everybody's favorite sparring partner for a little while. They said I couldn't fight, but they said I couldn't continue to spar and train and all that. And obviously, then I learned how to start coaching and coached a ton of guys over these years. Who was those early days you were talking about, right? And with your crews, training Bruce Lee and Judo Gene LaBelle and all that. Who kind of stands out? Because I trained with Dan Asanto just for a weekend.
Sure.
Who was unbelievable, right? Who were those early legends stands out for you?
Dennis Alexio was really good to me when I was a kid. He was a former ISKA heavyweight kickboxing champion. Beat the hell out of Bronco Sikatic in Hawaii. Weird finish because Bronco claimed he didn't know leg kicks were allowed, so they started the fight over, and Dennis beat his ass again. Rick Rufus was really cool to me when I was a kid. Brian Hurry, who was his best friend, who competed at the national level, is still one of my closest friends to this day. Big-ass Brian. He's another Milwaukee boy, 6'5", 260. He's in his 50s now, and it still looks like a stone killer. He's just a monster. Pat Johnson, Chuck Norris taught me how to throw the wheel kick. But he was, you know, a working actor, so he wasn't like my full-time coach where Pat really was. Gokor for a little bit, which was Pat's student. Yep. But I fell in love with jiu-jitsu, and they introduced me to a man named Jean-Jacques Machado.
Sure.
And I thought I was a hot shit wrestler at 14, 15 when I met him. And in less than 10, well, he had one hand. So I'm like, I had gone with guys that were older than me before and done well. And I'm like, this guy's not going to have anything. And I didn't know that he had just beat the hell out of Chuck and Bob. And they gave Jean-Jacques and all his brothers their first real estate space. It was in Wall Street Village. That was Bob Wall's building. And so they were there rent free. That's how good they were. And in less than 10 seconds, he had me in a fireman's carry and stood up and spins me around on the second floor and goes, which window, little Freddy, which window? And I'm like Chris Tucker in Rush Hour, like, which one of y'all just kicked me, right? And so he set me down and he started teaching me how comfortable he was on his back and why he was comfortable there. And that was my introduction to jiu-jitsu. This was like 1992, 93.
Oh, wow.
And then, as I started working in this business, my training slacked. And then as I took time off, my training increased. I met the Gracies after that, trained with them for a while, and then found my way back to Jean-Jacques a few years ago and have just been with him ever since. I love training with the man. He's always been good to my family. He's taught me more about fatherhood than jiu-jitsu, so it's something I try to enforce on my kids as well. My son takes to it more than my daughter. But, we're in L.A., so they get access to the best. Like, his boxing coach was Wayne McCullough. He was seven. Like, when your kids have access to that, it's just like it feels crazy not to use it. So we do as a family. Sarah trained taekwondo, got all the way to a brown belt before she became the busiest woman in Hollywood and worked 17 hours a day on Buffy back in the day. But, yeah, man, I still love it to this day. I still train. It keeps me sane. Yeah. It keeps me sharp. It keeps me vulnerable, which I think is important.
That's exactly right.
And it's made me a better man.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, my training partners end up being, you know, Randy Couture and Chuck Liddell. And
Jesus Christ.
After we, you know, be in the cage beating the hell out of each other, that's where we get really vulnerable and start opening up about, you know, our shitty relationships and whatever's going on between our ears. And people come past, especially Randy and I, we'd cry our eyes out. And people walk past the cage and not really get it. They'd be like, man, these guys are crying. They really beat the hell out of each other. We're just opening up to each other.
When you spar with someone and you're trusting them enough to give them opportunities to practice what you've been discussing, and they in turn are giving you opportunities for you to execute, like there has to be a next level of trust there. And that's why they say like blood, sweat, and tears is the ultimate glue, right? As my godfather used to say, blood, sweat, and tears is the ultimate glue. It makes men stick. And it does, man. Like, that's why they were all brothers. That's why they all wanted to beat the crap out of Steven Seagal in the 90s. And that whole group of them were like, screw you. We want you to die. You know, because they were brothers. They had cut each other. They had bled with one another. They had cried in each other's arms. You know, same kind of thing, man. Yeah. It's a different experience. People that haven't experienced it won't get it. It'll just sound like Yoda BS.
Right.
But it's not. Once you have it once, it's why people talk about it like a religion, because it really humbles you and it opens you up, man.
But it gives you this type of team. Again, for me, like one of my pillars of getting through my grade and depression, anxiety is to have a team. And there's no more, you know, primal team, if you will, but loving team than these guys. And people, you're right, they don't understand. Like, well, you could all beat the shit at each other, but then really love each other even more than the rest of us. Yeah.
More than your other friends.
Yeah. Like, you don't get angry at each other? I'm like, no, I love them more for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's we all need some sort of fight team, even if you don't literally fight. That's what I call a fight team, where you know that people will walk this walk with you to a different level.
Not even 15 feet to my right are my wrestling mats over there. And even if it's not like with John Jocks, my buddy's an ex-Marine, Tyler Smith. He fought for a little bit. He's got a black belt in jiu-jitsu. Like, he'll come over and we'll just get on the mats and go. And I don't even ask what's going on, but I'm like, something happened today.
Something happened. Yep.
And we need to roll. So come on over and let's go. You know, so you just know at a certain point, like, yeah, okay, my bro needs me. Let's do our thing.
Couture just got out of the hospital from a widowmaker heart attack in our gym.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He had it in the gym, Unbreakable, at the own on Sunset Strip, and then walked to the Cedar Sinai, and he gets a stent put in, and he comes back 3 weeks later into the gym, and he goes in and he gets all stuff on. I said, what are you doing? He said, let's go. I said, dude, what are we doing here? He's like, let's go. I said,
yeah, it better be a photo shoot.
You just had a widowmaker heart attack, full on widowmaker heart attack. And he just said this, I would do it for you. I was like, fuck me. Right? But that's the brotherhood, right?
That's a hook you can't get out of your mouth.
I got to do it, man.
You could be Jaws and you're hooked and that's it. That's it.
We went in there and beat the shit out of each other for 15 minutes and took his gloves off, threw him on the ground. He said, hey, fuck those doctors, and walked out of the cage.
Yeah.
That's that different brotherhood, man, right?
Fuck those doctors. I know it's not responsible for someone like me to say it, but sometimes you know what your heart needs. You know what your body needs. I know people that are like, you'll never run again.
And my man ran
the LA marathon the next year and were like, screw that. I'll show you. And he was in better shape than me.
By the time I'd gotten to critical care of the hospital post-op, I was like basically busting through to go see him. The doctor told me 10 times, hey, your friend's days of fighting, those days are over. I'm like, hey, let's not fucking say that here. Yeah. Let's not take away his hope. So that was his version of, hey, fuck these doctors.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he
straight up.
And then, by the way, he continued to coach for the next 3 hours after our little 15 minutes. So that's what that
guy's a unicorn though at the same time.
Yeah, he's different. You know what I mean? That fucker's different. Yeah. No doubt. Hey, you and your wife are different. When you talk about her martial, but you know, Hollywood couples, you normally look at him like, oh man, this is a disaster. Right. And you and your beautiful wife, who, like you said, has been working for a long, long time.
Yeah, man.
Why do you and Sarah Michelle Gellar work so much? What is it that you guys set out that, you know, the rest of, I guess, Hollywood fucked up and this hasn't sunk into you guys?
Look, I don't know a simple answer. I will say this. You know, if you look at the national divorce rate in our whole country, it's over 50%. You know what I mean? In Hollywood, it's probably more like 90, but 50 is not a good number. You know what I mean? So I think a lot of people get married maybe too young. You know, they don't know themselves 100% yet. And as you discover who you are in a relationship, if you make a big change, you may no longer be the person that your spouse married. You know what I mean? And I think that breaks a lot of people up. I think it's also a tradition that's not for everyone. And some people feel pressured to be a part of it. But as far as what makes it work for us, Sarah and I were friends first. She knew what kind of man I was. I knew what kind of woman she was. And then when we started dating, there was no honeymoon period because our friendship was that. So it was, trust was easier to come by. I already knew her faults, right? She already knew my faults. She knew, I told her, I was like, look, I'm gonna play video games till I'm 60. Like, I don't care. If you think that sucks, that's too bad for you. We won't go out, I promise. And so she was like, yeah, cool. She's like, I like reality TV. Don't talk shit about it. I'm like, right on, do your thing. So we don't shit all over each other, which I think is priority one. We still make one another laugh, which is priority two. And I still think she's hot and she still thinks I'm, you know, moderately decent looking. So all that aside, I, you know, have a skill they don't, you know, she can't cook. I can. So she can't get rid of me unless she wants her food cost to go up.
I'd marry you for that.
You ain't the first guy to tell me that either.
What are kind of some of the pitfalls of being a Hollywood couple that, let's say, the rest of America doesn't really have to deal with?
People wanting to fuck you 24 hours a day. Okay. That tends to be a problem. You look at the reason why most of these relationships break up is because somebody's screwing somebody else. Okay. You know what I mean? So I think there's a lot more opportunity for fame. I mean, maybe I'm not supposed to say this, but like, that's the way it is. Like, people see famous people and they just look at them differently. And there's a lot more opportunity for those people to cheat. It's more often men than women. At least that's what is released in the media. So that's, I'll go with that. I don't know if women are out there as horny as men are or not, but you know, that goes to maybe you shouldn't have got married in the first place because you don't 100% know yourself. And if you don't know yourself, I'm telling you, you're gonna change. Even when you do, like, I'm not the same guy I was 10 years ago, not even close. And compared to when I was 20, I was one of the dumbest sons of bitches on earth. At 21 years old, I'm 47 now and just figured out, wow, pretty stupid. I got to learn some more shit. You know what I mean? But I thought I had it in my 30s. I was like, got it. We're good. Don't need any more advice. And then hit like 35 and was like talking to my godfather every other day. Like, what am I doing with my life? Is this a mistake? Should I not have retired? Why did I join the WWE? Was that stupid? He's like, no, that was your dream. You loved it. You actually got to like help some of those guys and girls. Like, yeah, all right. So, you know, I'm still working it out today.
Wow, that's That definitely hits for me. It definitely hits home for me. It does.
Yeah. Hey, we'll humble each other as the podcast goes.
I just got engaged. I'm 53.
Congrats. Would you wait it? Good.
I had a couple bad ones beforehand, but I think in the past two, I would sabotage and push everybody away. I didn't feel worthy.
Men do that a lot, especially men that struggle for success. That's a very big Sigmund Freud thing is men who become hyper successful but struggled for that success often have self-worth issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it bleeds into sexual relationships and loving relationships, things like that. So that's normal, dude. That's just normal shit.
And this girl, her name's Rosie Tennyson. She and her sister, Renee Tennyson, they were the Doubleman twins back in the day.
Get out of town.
Yeah. They've kind of been in the business.
What if one of them's like, hey, I'm busy tonight. I don't want to hurt Jay's feelings. Will you take him to the beach? It's hard to tell
when they're on either side of you because you can't, they talk exactly the same. They sound exactly the same. They look exactly the same. Renee parts her hair in the middle. Rosie, my girl, parts her hair on the side.
Thank God for that.
It's bad. Yes, but it's bad. And I'll kind of go in, grab the wrong hand or going for the wrong ass cheek by accident. So wrong one. That's it. Nice. Wrong one. And
nice.
But the point is, they're used to it though. They're used. Yeah. But Rosie also, we were together beforehand and we split because I did push away and I wasn't. But that, like you're saying, you went at 35 and said, man, I got to learn some new stuff. At 52, I said, I really got to go learn some new things and learn that I'm worthy of this, that, the grade doesn't deserve to beat me. My depression, anxiety don't. They can't win. They're not going to set the stage for the rest of my life.
And so it's never a fight. Too late. Yeah, it's a fight. But you need the tool. A lot of people don't have the tools to fight it. And that's why they feel like they're losing all the time. And that's why I encourage my friends to get help. If venting to me is not working, then, find a doctor, find a counselor, find somebody that can help give you the weapons you need to fight this fight. Because it's a legit fight. People that suffer with it. I have. You know what I mean? And it's... questioning yourself damages your soul, man. It damages your soul. And if you do it too much, it's irreparable. So you got to get it in check. You got to get it in check, man, because your soul is what grants you success. Your soul is when it's as dark and horrible and bad as it is. Your soul's either the drill sergeant that's like, get up now. You're not done. Or it's that nurturing, mother type figure where it's like, you're going to be okay. This is bad, but pain is temporary. Tomorrow's a new day. But it's one or the other, right? Maybe somebody out there has another version of it. But for me, that's what it's
like. Yeah.
So, yeah, you got to that talking shit to yourself. There's enough people that'll find reasons to hate you. You don't need to join in.
Yeah. The roommates in my head didn't talk nicely to each other and still don't. But now I know how to handle them better. And for the first time, I felt worthy. And that's where, hey, it's never too late.
That's
right. It's never too late, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's big time.
Before I let you go, got two more things. One, I want to talk about your podcast. I'm going to hit you on your unbreakable moment. So we talked about Wrestling with Freddie. Tell us about that. You got to have me on that one time.
Look, dude, if you love wrestling, man, come on. I grew up loving it. And I mean loving it. I only liked the bad guys because they were the ones who won on free TV, the pay-per-views.
Right.
Pay, right? And we were broke, so that wasn't going to happen. But when I walked away from the business in 07, I randomly took a job, and I mean randomly took a job for WWE, and I worked there for 2 years and worked directly with talent, flew to every single or drove to every single show. I was crazy disciplined. Then I started a family, walked away. The first season of the podcast was my experience there, and now it's more my perspective on the business today and who I love. And then we go on side quests as things happen that remind me of crazy stories that happened. Right. But it's just more storytelling at its heart, and it's called Wrestling with Freddie. Yeah.
Great, man. That's fantastic. Like I said, I was WrestleMania 1. The Rock wrote the foreword to my book.
My baby sister, The Rock.
Yep. Which is great.
Yo, Sarah made a movie with The Rock that both of them hate. It was not a good movie. But he took so many big swings in it. And you can really watch the development of that dude's career from Scorpion King to where he is now. Same with Batista. You can really see the growth in both those guys.
Yeah. No, Dwayne and I did 5 years in Ballers together where I play my normal dickhead self, so that was great. And just because of how much I fuck with them, they kept like, let's keep it in,
That's great, though.
My ADD, I can't remember scripts, so I would just kind of do my own
thing.
They
just let you wing it, yeah. But as long as the actors around you can hang, then it's all good.
Well, I got a lot of friends in that business, man, and, Batista and Mark Henry and Big Show. And
Mark's the best, dude.
Yeah, isn't
Mark's
he?
The friggin' oh my God. Best, man. I love that phenomenal. Dude so much, man.
He walks in Unbreakable, and he says, hey, man, any chance you got a 54 shorts around here? I'm like, who the fuck would have a 54 shorts laying around?
There's not that much cotton in this town. Like, it would have to be made of hemp.
He says, hey, 54 in the waist, sexy in the face.
That's right, baby.
That sums him up, man. So
that's right.
Hey, before I let you go, I ask all my guests this. Give me your unbreakable moment. One thing in life, man, that could have broken you, should have broken you, but it didn't. And as a result, you came through the other side of that tunnel stronger forever.
Yeah, I mean, we touched on it earlier because I definitely, there's nothing unbreakable about me. Being breakable is what keeps me sharp. It's what keeps me focused. It's what keeps me disciplined, knowing that all this precious life, everything I have, it can all be gone in a moment's notice if life doesn't turn out the way it's supposed to. So every time those moments come, I really try to be prepared for them. When I decided to move to Los Angeles and pursue this business, that was one of those make or break moments. I could have quit. I could have given up. I hated being told no. I hated being told I wasn't good enough. I hated having bad auditions when I knew I had a better performance somewhere inside me. I just couldn't get it out at that moment. I had moments in the car where I wanted to turn around and be like, go, give me one more chance. But you can't do that. It's so unprofessional. So there were times where I was ready to walk away. And then, you know, it was that discipline from my godfather, you know, and those BS quotes that he would always hit me with. I'm in control of my actions and my reactions to the actions of others. And so every no I heard, I just had to control the way that made me feel. And it was, all right, you don't think I'm good enough? You'll see. And then the next time I went in, I made sure I was better. I had to hustle. I had to lie. I did everything I could to get as many auditions and as much experience as I could so that when those big dogs called me in, they couldn't talk shit. Like they wouldn't be able to deny me. And eventually I broke through. You know, I had to wait for Skeet Ulrich to be busy because we popped at the same time. But once he booked a movie, I was like, all right, there's going to be 6 opportunities. Right. I got to get one of them.
See, I want to correct you here because you said you're not unbreakable. You are unbreakable because there's a lot of things that could have broken you, but you didn't stay down. That's the
problem. In the permanent sense, 100%.
Damn right.
I couldn't agree more.
Hey, man, I appreciate you, brother. Thank you so much. Again, Wrestling with Freddie, his wrestling podcast. Make sure everybody here tunes into that. Dude, can't thank you enough, man. You know, hopefully you and I can break some bread. And, man, shit, if Strahan won't get his ass back out here, you can teach me how to surf.
Not a problem, man. We live pretty close to each other. So
no doubt, man.
And to all your listeners, it's a fight every day. So put your hands up.
Love it. Freddie Prinze Jr., thank you, my dude.
Yeah, man, my pleasure.
Mother's Day is right around the corner. And in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.